On September 8th, 1966, a new television series debuted on Impulse Power.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages.
Telling a tale of exploration and adventure in a space saga that, while only lasting three seasons, has gone on at warp speed to inspire an entertainment empire that has lived long and prospered. The original Star Trek series led to several more TV shows and over a dozen films. Sherry Zeck, Associate Dean of the College of Fine Arts at Illinois State University and GLT's culture maven, says the original Star Trek is special for a lot of reasons. When it originally debuted 50 years ago, it wasn't a huge hit, but it found new life in syndication and beyond. Zeck says right from the start, Star Trek found a small but loyal and, importantly, an active audience.
So they put a lot of pressure on the network to keep it going, particularly for that third season, and then obviously to bring it back later for the later series and the movies.
Are we talking about proto-Trekkies?
Oh, yeah. Trekkies. Absolutely Trekkies.
So what is it about this show? Was it the characters that made it so engaging with audiences? Was it the storylines? What's going on with Star Trek that made it so wonderful?
I think it really spoke to its own time, but spoke to the values of that time that persist in our culture, or at least in our cultural imagination. That it was a show which, again, we've spoken about this before when we talked about Star Wars, but it's a show that was a modification on a very familiar, very resilient genre, the Western. Roddenberry himself thought of it as a Western that was also a morality tale. One of his going titles for the series was Wagon Train to the Stars. Whether that was ever serious or whether it was just kind of a joke or a way to explain what the show was, I'm not really sure. But it was a morality tale about integration, about peace, about the place of violence within an ethic of peacekeeping and an ethic of adhering to the prime directive, which is do not interfere with another culture. And yet what they did in every episode was interfere with another culture. So it had layers to it that people apprehended quickly, that people felt akin to, and that continue to circle around issues that we wrestle with as a culture. I think that's part of its persistent appeal. But then obviously the characters were great and the actors became beloved, whether they were fabulous actors or not. There's a lot of debate about that, but they were very much beloved and very much tied to their characters' ethos and their characters' being. People were very taken with characters like Spock, the notion of someone having a very different emotional makeup or non-makeup, as it were.
I prefer the concrete, the graspable, the provable.
You'd make a splendid computer, Mr. Spock.
That is very kind of you, Captain.
An alien who was incorporated into this largely international Earth-based conglomeration of people was very much of interest to people. People try and link the popularity of Star Trek to the space program at the time. I think that's not necessarily the case.
Why not?
Well, I mean, space travel was on people's minds and the notion of what's out there, but you know, H.G. Wells was writing about aliens decades before, and it was pretty popular. So I think that it's a little too easy to say the space program had people jazzed up about life in outer space, and that's why Star Trek was a success. I think it was a whole collection of features of the series and the characters and the kinds of themes that Roddenberry and his crew took on. And there were great writers involved with that show. Harlan Ellison, you know, lots of other people.
I was shocked to discover DC Fontana was a woman.
Yes.
and that's why she went by DC, because they were afraid that the science fiction fans wouldn't take her seriously as a woman writing science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Very surprising to me. Yet, you know, they had there on the bridge, Lieutenant Uhura. She was head of communications, you know, and when I was a kid watching it in syndication, she was my favorite.
Progress report.
I'm connecting the bypass circuit now, sir. It should take another half hour.
Speed is essential, Lieutenant.
Mr. Spock, I haven't done anything like this in years. If it isn't done just right, I could blow the entire communication system. It's very delicate work, sir.
I can think of no one better equipped to handle it, Miss Uhura. Please proceed.
I totally looked up to her.
Yes, sir.
Because she was not only in charge, but she was glamorous with those long red nails.
Yes.
Amazing.
She was, well, and, you know, she had headphones and did communications, and look where you are.
I know.
So, yeah, she was pretty cool. I was a Spock fan, of course. But it's also worth noting that in Roddenberry's original concept, women were even in bigger roles of power, in that in the original concept, the first officer was going to be a woman.
So the network probably balked at that, saying, oh, no, mm-hmm. no, we need a man in there. Why are you such a fan, Sherry?
Why am I such a fan?
Yeah, why are you such a fan? I mean, is it fair to call you a Trekkie or Trekker?
I've never dressed up in a Star Trek suit. But
you've never gone to Comic-Con or anything
I've never
like
gone
that.
To Comic-Con. I don't have plastic ears. I do have all of Leonard Nimoy's albums, however.
Really?
Yes.
Which is your favorite?
Two Sides of Leonard Nimoy, in which he has the song It's Illogical.
From far beyond the galaxies, I've journeyed to this place to study the behavior patterns of the human race. And I find them highly illogical.
One side of the album is him singing as, you know, a regular guy. And the other side, he's doing songs as if he were Spock, as I recall.
What's the appeal of Spock?
Well, first of all, people may think that it's Kirk who is the Western hero, you know, the man of action, blah, blah, blah. But it's really more Spock, or if you want to be careful about it, it's split into the two of them. Because if you think of those great heroes of cinema Westerns, John Wayne characters, Gary Cooper characters, they're all people who keep their emotions to themselves. They're all people who suppress their own desires for the good of the order. So it's Spock who carries that containment of self that we generally value in male, or have valued in male heroes of the first half of the 20th century and before, and some after. So there's some of that that's generally appealing, but also, particularly, I think, as the character developed beyond the original series, the fact that he came to his suppression of emotion, which is a thing he struggles with in all the best episodes, or where he loses it, of course, like A Mock Time and some of the others, but that he struggles with being this unemotional, logical person, but it comes from a philosophic base of more or less Buddhism. That's not what it's called in the series, obviously, but a lot of it comes from Eastern philosophy. And from a history with his own culture that is a history of turning away from the violence and destruction that comes from emotional responses. So it's a character that immediately signals a struggle, an internal struggle that I think we enjoy seeing. And he was also smarter than everybody else.
I think one of the things that makes Star Trek so fascinating is the way it's such a permanent, important part of our pop culture because it's really added to our lexicon.
Oh, yes. Well, beam me up, Scotty. There's a lot of times when I'm sitting in a meeting at work that I think, beam me up, Scotty.
And I think a lot of us do.
I actually have my text alerts on my phone set to various Star Trek sounds.
That's so wonderfully geeky.
That's just my version of geeky.
Well, let's talk about, I mean, it's not just a TV show. It's the original seed that has spawned many plants.
Yes,
we have, you know, Next Generation and the movies and Voyager, and there's going to be a new one. There's going to be a new TV show, Star Trek Discovery. is going to be coming up shortly. Is that really unusual in show business that one little show that lasted 3 years has quite a family tree?
Yeah, I mean you can point to radio shows like radio dramas like Stella Dallas that prompted a couple of movies, three movies at this point, or Search for Tomorrow, which had a long life as a radio series and then an extremely long life as a television series. So you can find longevity in series in other ways, the various iterations of Sherlock Holmes, that sort of thing. But for something to begin in the 60s, not as an old serial that has fallen out of copyright and gets replayed in various ways, but begins in the 60s, is not a particularly successful film, and then is really pushed and propagated by the fans that essentially saves Paramount and makes it an empire again.
Cecil B. DeMille would be so happy.
He would be just delighted. That is quite incredible.
Well, yeah. Why the long shelf life? Why are we never tired? We just don't seem to satisfy our appetite for various iterations of Star Trek.
One thing, it has very high production values. Now, that's not true of the first series, right? Where it was made on a shoestring and the fancy dress outfits were some cheap rickrack on some polyester T-shirts. But it was after that, a lot of money was put into the series. So it had high production values. It has always had great writing and great ideas. I wasn't really a fan of Deep Space Nine or Enterprise, but great writing, great ideas, these classic themes, as I said before, iterated in different ways. And then all the ancillary activities, right? I remember playing Star Trek when I was a kid. And
okay, were you Spock?
Of course I was Spock. I was always the coolest one. And look, we all knew that the captain was the captain, but it was really nothing was going to happen without Spock.
Mm-hmm.
He was the one who was really the power behind the throne. So yes, I was Spock. And so the characters were easy for us to imagine ourselves into and to play with. And it also, there's a huge amount of invention that has come out of the fan community. Fanzines, people writing novels, creating a whole Klingon language. I mean, a whole Klingon language, okay?
There are people who are taking their wedding vows in Klingon.
Yeah, okay.
Because they're so into it. I mean, when we think about the Trekkies, they were originally, like in the 70s and 80s, they were ridiculed. But now we look at them and their extreme devotion, and it's everywhere. Mm-hmm. We can see it attached to Star Wars and other entertainment options out there. They were clearly, it seems to me, ahead of their time.
Well, yes, and of course, now big franchises like that want to cultivate that kind of following. They put it within their promotional activities to try and cultivate that sort of following. And going to Comic-Con or some of the other big conventions is a big deal. It's written into actors' contracts. Some of the actors in smaller roles, I mean, they continue to make their income on into their later lives by doing these kinds of things. It's obviously huge, huge, huge business in a lot of ways. I think Star Trek really, I'm always hesitant to say something was first, but it was among the first that in which fans opened up a space for their own creativity. And then that began to have an effect on the series itself. Not quite as clearly as, say, with a later show like Xena, in which the fan community was so active, it not only kept it on the air and gave it a worldwide following, one writer of fan fiction eventually wrote an episode for the series. So it wasn't that kind of direct, but Gene Roddenberry and then his successors have learned from the fans and kept the core values of what the series is about intact throughout all of its iterations. That is really key to its ongoing appeal and ongoing success. I just said I don't like Deep Space Nine very well, but I watched it. Okay. Well, okay, I didn't watch the last couple seasons, but I just saw the film this summer. And I'm not going to say that Star Trek is my most favorite thing on Earth, but it's a thing. I like it. And when I saw this summer's film, I walked out of the theater and I was really sad.
Why?
Because I'm going to have to wait another couple years before I see them again. The characters are so great that
you felt bereft, and it's like, now I have to wait to see them again.
It is like being separated from your familiars, whom you trust and you know and you rely on in some way and are obviously entertained by. And they have these characters, even though we're in some alternate timeline or something, which I don't understand, these characters have lived in many of our imaginations for so long that they have that familiarity of family.
And we have a lot invested in them over the years.
A lot invested in them.
Sherry, can you tell me about a couple of your favorite episodes from the original Star Trek?
Well, my favorite episodes usually revolve around Spock being aberrant in some way. So I love A Mock Time, where basically he goes into heat and has
Pon
to
Farr.
That's right, and has to get back home, and you know, all of that Stan, you may find that having a thing is not so great as wanting it. I love that. And the two episodes that were really a way of incorporating the original pilot for the series, in which Spock hijacks the Enterprise to get his first captain, Captain Pike, back to this planet where he landed and adventures ensued and that sort of thing. So those are my personal favorites. Some of the ones that are fan favorites in general really escape me. The Tribbles thing.
I want these things off the ship. I don't care if it takes every man we've got. I want them off the ship.
Aye, they're into the machinery, all right. And they're probably in all the other food processors, too.
How?
Probably through one of the air vents.
I cannot stand. I cannot stand to watch that episode at all. It's just silly. Actually, there's a whole little mini series within the original series, a collection of episodes. And I was checking this morning to see if they had writers in common, and they don't, that are among my favorites too. And one is the Apollo episode. Again, I don't know the title, I'm sorry, but the guy who thinks he's Apollo. There's the one where the two crew members get zapped or something and they become hyper-intelligent. And then, again, one of my absolute favorites, but again, it's because Spock gets to be aberrant in it, where the three beings from the future who have their minds encased in these globes mm-hmm. take over Kirk, Spock's, take over their bodies, and then one of them doesn't want to let go and blah, 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 blah. But taking on this notion of, is there a limit to human intelligence? Once you go beyond a certain level of human intelligence, do you border into evil irrevocably? Is it possible to be too smart? And the series seems to be saying yes, that you've got to just kind of be smart enough. And so even with these, with, you know, Spock who's smarter than anybody else and Kirk who's braver and sexier than anybody else. I do not get that, but anyway. And medicine, which has advanced way beyond our imagining. Even with all of those things, they're all kind of average Joes in a certain way. And the series is rather against exceptionality. It's rather more invested in typicality. And I think that is actually part and parcel of how it presents a vision of an integrated future. It's not just that we have someone with a Russian accent on the bridge, of course, for the 60s, that's incredibly important.
Yeah.
And an African-American woman on the bridge, of course, for the 60s, that's incredibly important. But that they are not exceptional people, really. That helps them seem to represent a whole change in society.
That's Sherry Zeck, GLT's culture maven. To celebrate the 50th anniversary of Star Trek, CBS and Paramount have teamed up to release a Blu-ray boxed set edition of the series. I'm Laura Kennedy.